New York. This is Democracy Now!
Does President Biden plan to honor his pledge to nominate a black woman to the court?
Well, I've commented on this previously. The president has stated and reiterated his commitment to nominating a black woman to the Supreme Court and certainly stands by that.
Liberal Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring after nearly 30 years on the bench, giving President Biden a chance to fulfill a campaign promise to nominate the first black woman to the high court. We'll look at possible nominees, Breyer's legacy, and the future of the court. Plus, we'll look at the lords of easy money.
The Fed has pumped over $3.5 trillion directly into the Wall Street banking system at the same time that it has held interest rates at zero for over 7 years. This has stoked the divide between the very, very rich and everybody else, and it has created these massive asset bubbles that are starting to crash right now as the Fed tries to withdraw this stimulus.
As the Federal Reserve signals it'll raise interest rates in March, we'll talk to author Christopher Leonard. He says the Fed's broken the American economy. And we talked to a top Cuban scientist about how Cuba's developed its own COVID vaccines despite the 60-year-old U.S. embargo. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Justice Stephen Breyer is planning to retire from the Supreme Court after 27 years of service. Breyer's retirement gives President Biden his first chance to nominate a Supreme Court justice, but will not change the ideological makeup of the court's 6-3 conservative majority. At 83, Breyer is the court's oldest justice. He faced intense pressure to retire ahead of November's midterm elections while Democrats still control the Senate. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said Biden's nominee would receive a prompt hearing. As a candidate, Biden vowed to appoint the first black woman to the Supreme Court. We'll have more on the retirement of Justice Breyer and who might replace him after headlines. Russian officials said they're not optimistic after receiving responses Wednesday from the U.S. and NATO over demands made by Russia that NATO halt its eastward expansion. The U.S. and NATO did not reveal the content of the letters, but Secretary of State Antony Blinken confirmed the U.S. and its allies did not agree to curb its expansion, but offered a path forward for negotiations with Moscow.
We make clear that there are core principles that we are committed to uphold and defend, including Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the right of states to choose their own security arrangements and alliances.
Meanwhile, the military buildup continues on both sides of the Russia-Ukraine border, where some 100,000 Russian troops have been amassed for weeks. Earlier this week, the U.S. put 8,500 troops on heightened alert to deploy to the region if needed. In Congress, top progressive Democrats Pramila Jayapal and Barbara Lee called on the Biden administration Wednesday to pursue diplomacy amidst the escalation tensions, warning there is no military solution to the crisis. The Biden administration's approved a weapons sale to Egypt valued at over $2.5 billion. This despite voicing concerns over human rights abuses by the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, which the U.S. government has used as justification for withholding $130 million in military aid. State Department spokesperson Ned Price was questioned about the weapons deal Tuesday.
What is the point of withholding $130 million in foreign military financing when you're just going to turn around and sell them $2.5 billion in weapons?
Matt, if we have anything to add on the report you're referencing, we'll let you know.
Meanwhile, a dozen House Democrats penned a letter calling on President Biden to stop servicing Saudi warplanes used in deadly attacks against civilians. The Democrats cited the recent airstrikes on a migrant detention center in Yemen, which killed over 70 people. New Jersey Congressmember Tom Malinowski added in a tweet that the, quote, continued servicing of these jets could make the United States complicit in these likely war crimes. In Syria, Kurdish-led forces backed by U.S. helicopter gunships have recaptured a prison in the northeastern city of Hasakeh, ending a week-long battle that began when Islamic State fighters attempted a jailbreak. The fighting left more than 180 people dead. The siege ended after the U.S.-backed Syrian defense forces cut off food and water to the jail for 2 days. More than 700 imprisoned children, some as young as 12, were reportedly used as human shields during the siege. Last year, a United Nations report found conditions inside the prison amount to torture, with prisoners packed in overcrowded cells, denied access to sunlight, medical care, and proper nutrition. The United Nations is calling on countries to allow humanitarian aid to flow into Afghanistan, where an estimated 23 million people face acute food shortages. Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council Wednesday more than half of Afghan's citizens are facing extreme levels of hunger, with some families forced to sell their babies so they can buy food.
6 months after the takeover by the Taliban, Afghanistan is hanging by a thread. For Afghans, daily life has become a frozen hell.
The UN Secretary General said $1.2 billion from the World Bank-administered Afghan Reconstruction Trust Fund should be freed up immediately, and humanitarian aid groups should be allowed to operate in Afghanistan without fear of breaching sanctions imposed after the Taliban takeover last August. The World Health Organization says nations reported 21 million new coronavirus cases last week, the highest weekly toll of the pandemic. This comes as the Financial Times reports the COVAX initiative to bring vaccines to poor and middle-income nations is unable to accept new donations because it's nearly exhausted the funds needed to buy crucial accessories, including syringes. COVAX recently delivered its 1 billionth vaccine dose. The group's goal was to deliver 2 billion doses by the end of 2021. Yale epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves tweeted in response, quote, "This is why the charity model of vaccine delivery cannot work. Share the technology now for mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. Pfizer and Moderna are prolonging this pandemic with their greed," Gonsalves tweeted. The United States reported nearly 3,900 COVID-19 deaths Wednesday, the highest daily toll since last winter's surge. Hospitalizations remain near record highs, though the number of reported daily infections is falling rapidly. Spotify is removing Neil Young's music from its catalog after Young demanded the streaming platform drop podcast host Joe Rogan. Rogan has a history of promoting baseless conspiracy theories about the pandemic and untested treatments for COVID-19, and he's repeatedly spread misinformation about vaccines. In an open letter, Neil Young blasted misinformation on Spotify's podcasts and said, quote, "They can have Rogan or Young, not both." On Wednesday, Spotify sided with Rogan and began taking Neil Young's songs offline. The Joe Rogan Experience is the world's most popular podcast with an estimated 11 million listeners per episode. In 2020, Rogan signed a deal with Spotify reportedly worth over $100 million. In California, the city of San Jose has passed a first-of-its-kind ordinance requiring gun owners to carry liability insurance and pay a yearly fee. The measure was introduced last May after a city transit worker fatally shot 9 co-workers before turning the gun on himself. San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo compared the legislation to laws requiring car drivers to carry insurance.
Those who are not complying with this very simple regulation will face consequences, and with the help of some state legislation, may well suffer the forfeiture of the guns as well.
The group Gun Owners of California has promised to sue San Jose to block the ordinance from taking effect next month. Meanwhile, gun control groups are condemning Illinois-based gun maker WE1 Tactical for producing a smaller version of the AR-15 assault rifle and marketing it to children with promotional materials that feature cartoon skulls and baby pacifiers. The Violence Policy Center responded, quote, that a gun maker has embraced imagery of dead children to promote gun ownership by youth surreally illustrates how detached this industry is from the death and injury that result from its products, unquote. The Biden administration's canceled leases for a proposed copper-nickel mine in northern Minnesota. Environmentalists are cheering the decision, which they say will protect pristine wilderness in the Boundary Waters region near the Canadian border. And high school students in Granbury, Texas, are fighting back against school officials who are pushing to ban hundreds of books dealing with social inequality. This is high school senior Isabella Guzman, who joined fellow students in speaking out at a public meeting earlier this week.
I am queer, I am brown, and I'm very proud of that. And I am well aware of the censorship that has happened to my people over the centuries. I'm well aware of this, and I think it is horrible. And I don't think that little children should be shocked or disgusted by our identities. And I think it's disgusting that even in 2022, we still have to have these discussions about censorship.
The crackdown in Texas schools is part of a growing conservative-led trend to censor books on race, colonialism, sexual and gender identity, and other issues in schools and libraries across the U.S. Earlier this month, a Tennessee school board voted to ban Mouse by the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel about the Holocaust by Art Spiegelman. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Liberal Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring after serving on the court for over 27 years. Breyer's retirement gives President Biden his first opportunity to pick a justice for the high court, which has a 6-3 conservative majority. At 83, Justice Breyer is the court's oldest justice. He'd faced intense pressure to retire while Democrats still controlled the Senate. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Biden's nominee said that Biden's nominee would receive a prompt hearing. As a candidate, Biden vowed to nominate the first Black woman to the Supreme Court. In the court's history, there have only been 4 female justices and 2 Black justices. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about Biden's plans.
Well, I've commented on this previously. The president has stated and reiterated his commitment to nominating a Black woman to the Supreme Court and certainly stands by that. For today, again, I'm just not going to be able to say anything about any specifics until, of course, Justice Breyer makes any announcement, should he decide to make an announcement.
The names of several possible nominees have already been floated, including Ketanji Brown Jackson, a U.S. Appeals Court judge who once served as a law clerk for Breyer, Leandra Kruger, a California Supreme Court justice, Michelle Childs, a U.S. District Court judge in South Carolina, and Sherrilyn Ifill, a civil rights attorney who heads the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Vice President Kamala Harris has also been mentioned as a possible nominee. To talk more about the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer and the future of the court, we're joined by 2 guests. Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and senior legal correspondent at Slate.com, where she hosts a podcast, Amicus. Her latest piece is headlined "The Deep Irony of Stephen Breyer's Bare-Knuckled Exit from the Supreme Court." Ellie Mistel is the nation's justice correspondent. His new piece headlined "The Supreme Court versus the Earth." His forthcoming book, "Allow Me to Retort: A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution." We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ellie, let's begin with you. Your response when you heard about Justice Breyer retiring and the tweet that you immediately put off, offering some suggestions.
Yeah, woo, let's go. This is about time. Look, Breyer's had a long and distinguished career. He has served the nation with integrity, and it was time for him to leave. And I have to say that that's not my doing. That is Mitch McConnell's doing. Mitch McConnell has promised essentially to not replace a Supreme Court justice should Republicans take back the Senate in 2023. We know he's not bluffing, because he stole the seat from Barack Obama when Obama nominated Merrick Garland. So we have to assume that Mitch McConnell will be true to his word. And that means that the timeline for Breyer to retire was now. He had to get out of the way so that his seat would not be lost to McConnell's machinations. So I'm glad that Breyer did the right thing. Moving on to the replacement, as you've mentioned, Biden promised to nominate a Black woman for the first time in the history of the Supreme Court. There have been 115 justices on the Supreme Court since the founding. 108 of them have been white men. So I think that if we're worried about identity politics, it's actually the white guys who have been picking white guys to be confirmed by white guys who maybe have been a little bit too focused on the race and gender of their nominees instead of looking for the most qualified candidate possible. If Biden keeps true to his campaign promise and only looks within historically disadvantaged groups, he will find a wealth of experience, qualifications, and intellect, even if he limits himself to the category of black women. Some of the leading contenders, as you mentioned, Ketanji Brown Jackson, we're talking about a Harvard College, Harvard Law School judge who clerked for Breyer, who was the head of the U.S. Censusing Commission, who has been on the court for 8 years. That's longer than Amy Coney Barrett. So she's kind of the leader in the clubhouse right now, but there are others, Leandra Kruger, California State Supreme Court Justice, editor of the Yale Law Review, Deputy Solicitor General. She writes like fire. She's one of the more eloquent advocates that you'll ever meet. J. Michelle Childs, a labor law expert, which seems kind of important just at the moment, given SCOTUS's attack on labor, especially in the OSHA mandates case. J. Michelle Childs, a district court judge from South Carolina. South Carolina, your viewers might remember, saved Joe Biden's campaign. She has the support of Jim Clyburn. She would also – she went to University of South Carolina for law school. She would be the first person on the Supreme Court with a law degree from a state school for – I can't remember the last time that happened. So we would have not just race and gender diversity but professional and educational diversity with Michelle Childs. And those are just a few of the plethora of people who Biden could pick even if he focuses just on black women.
And Dahlia, your response to hearing that Justice Breyer will step down, that he'll retire. He served for 27 years. And your piece is called, the latest piece, The Deep Irony of Stephen Breyer's Bare-Knuckled Exit from the Supreme Court. Why is it deeply ironic?
Well, because in some sense, I think Justice Breyer is the last of a dying breed. Maybe he's the last to know. He's the last of a dying breed, but he has really dedicated his nearly 30 years at the Supreme Court, but certainly the last 5 years, to the proposition that justices are not partisan, they are not political, that they are all dedicated to something much higher than bare-knuckled politics, and that he really devoted himself. As recently as this fall, when he wrote a book about it, gave a major speech about it, said that we're not politicians in robes. So I think the irony that I caught was that in the midst of protesting that we are not partisans, this is not a political institution, he made a very political move in stepping down when he did. He didn't even wait till the spring the way most justices do. I think he's well aware that if he had waited till June or July, Mitch McConnell could have attempted to do something to scuttle Biden's nomination and seating of someone before the 22 midterms. And so this act of saying simultaneously, we're above all this and justices don't think this way and this is not a political calculation, at the same time that I think certainly in my career, this is the most overt flagging of the fact that he needs to go now. As Ellie said, he needs to go because Mitch McConnell has made it plain that if the Senate goes to Republicans in 2022, McConnell's already said he won't see a Biden nominee in 2024, possibly in 2023. So this is just a sad irony. The guy is kind of closing the lights on his way out on an institution that I think he really idealized as beyond politics. And at the same time, it's so, so clear that politics drove him out right now.
And you interviewed him, Dahlia, just last winter. Did you anticipate his decision?
I did. I mean, he was very, very clear when I interviewed him, and I think folks who've interviewed him since, that he was certainly thinking about his retirement. But also, it was clear to me then and again over the course of the last year intervening, that he did not like the idea of being pushed out. And the more liberal groups tried to push him out, you may recall There were people who interrupted his book talks to tell him to leave. There was a truck driving around the Supreme Court telling him to leave this fall. So the more he got pressure, particularly from the left, the more he felt like he was going to make a statement and stick it out. Because even though this had happened to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she stayed on, in some sense, too long to affect who would replace her. He wasn't going to be a sacrifice to that symbolism. And yet, clearly, he did sacrifice himself to that symbolism. I think in a really deep way, this goes to a pattern we've seen. Even this term at the court, we've got tanking poll numbers, Gallup polling showing the court at the lowest ebb of public approval. We've got overt battles on the court over trivial things like wearing masks at argument, but really, I think, sharp and pointed language amongst the justices. And I think more and more one had the sense, even this term, that Justice Breyer just is, in a profound sense, beginning to give up on his dream of a bipartisan cooperative institution.
I mean, it's an unbelievable number, 115 Supreme Court justices. Of them, only seven are not, white men. That's pretty amazing. Seven either African American or women in all the court's history. Now, Ellie Mestal, I want to ask you about what the approval process could look like. You have the carve out of the filibuster. They don't need a supermajority. They just need the majority. But Harvard professor Lawrence Tribe has said that there is a precedent for saying that the vice president could not break the tie. Having said that, someone like Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was just approved, including three Republicans, by Lindsey Graham, Lisa Murkowski, as well as Susan Collins. She apparently is one of the top choices that people are saying President Biden is weighing, and that approval just took place. Can you talk about what you know of this, and maybe Dahlia wants to weigh in as well?
Yeah, so first of all, the Tribe argument that the vice president can't break ties, I've actually seen a couple of right-wing people spreading that around. It's based on an interpretation from the Federalist Papers, right? That the vice president can break ties in a legislative sense, but not in an appointment sense. That theory is off the wall, wackadoodle, and never been tested. But I would point out this. Who's going to check her? So it's 50-50, and Harris breaks the tie. Who's going to tell her no? Who's going to make that stop? What, is John Roberts going to sit in like, oh, no, you can't? Like, I under Obama, I would have been like, send Merrick Garland to the court and have him sit and go to work and wait for John Roberts to kick him out. And I would say the exact same thing to anybody who tried to pull this Federalist Papers dodge to stop Biden from having a nominee. However, I don't think it's going to get that contentious. And I know this could come back to bite me because I'm going to sound very naive if I'm wrong. But I think the Biden nominee is going to get 52, 53 votes. As you pointed out, Collins, Murkowski, and Graham actually already voted for Ketanji Brown Jackson in the past. They also voted for Candace Jackson Akume, who's another possibility, who was recently confirmed to the Seventh Circuit with 53 votes. So there's precedent on that. Manchin and Sinema have been pretty good about voting for Biden judges. I don't expect a lot of pushback from them or their handlers when it comes to this pick. You know, I think it might get Romney. Like, in part because, and I'll just close with this. If we're talking about the front runners, right? If we're talking about a Brown Jackson or a Kruger or somebody, their credentials are so impeccable. And there is no hint of scandal, right? I do not think we're going to find out that Brown Jackson tried to rape anybody in high school. I don't think we're going to find out that Brown Jackson perjured herself in congressional testimony, right? So we've got impeccable academic credentials, impeccable educational credentials, impeccable moral credentials. I just don't think that there's enough for Republicans to really come at this person with that's going to make this nomination all that difficult, even given our crazy politics, and you know, so I'll look like an idiot 3 months from now.
Even the former House Speaker Paul Ryan is related to Ketanji Brown Jackson, right? She's
married, right? Like,
to Jackson, who is the twin brother of the husband of Paul Ryan's sister-in-law.
I think, again, Republicans, you never go wrong underestimating Republicans, right? But I think that this nominee will go through with more than 50 votes. And if it comes down to 50-50, I don't see a real constitutional way to stop her from getting onto the court with Kamala Harris breaking the tie.
Dahlia, in 2017, then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell changed the rules so that the Supreme Court nominees could be confirmed by just 51 votes. Could you talk about the significance of that? What was it before? Why was it changed? And then second, the fact that Biden installed five African-American women on federal appeals courts. And almost all recent Supreme Court nominees have been federal appeals judges. Could you talk about that, both these issues?
The first is just we've seen, because there was massive, massive obstruction of Barack Obama's nominees on the federal appeals courts. And so Harry Reid took the decision to get rid of the filibuster for those nominees. That meant that as soon as we had the obstruction that Ellie talked about, where the decision was taken that even though there was nearly a year left in his term, President Obama's pick for Antonin Scalia's vacant seat, Merrick Garland, was going to get neither a hearing nor a vote nor even courtesy meetings from Republican senators. And once that obstruction happened, when Democrats filibustered the Gorsuch nominee, they just got rid of the filibuster. And that's the world we now live in. You can get a Supreme Court justice seated with a bare minority of 51 votes. And that's what Ellie's describing is likely to happen. I think that the thing that has been really remarkable about the Biden administration and gets not nearly enough attention is his absolute zealous commitment, not just to getting judges onto the federal bench, breaking numbers, doing it so quickly. And really, this has been important. And again, I don't think we've surfaced how important. He has been, from day one, committed to putting judges on the federal bench who are not just diverse, extraordinarily diverse. And we have seen, again, records shattered in terms of seating jurists who come from different racial, gender, LGBTQ backgrounds. That's been a real push, but also urgently important to him to put up the kinds of people who never got a look in prior administrations, people who come from voting rights activism, people who come from labor organizing, people who come from public defenders and other backgrounds who never would have gotten a judicial nod. And so it's been really, really important to him not just to put up record-breaking numbers of women of color and other groups that don't often get a look, but it's been really important to put up people who are not typically prosecutors or folks who clerked on the courts. And one of the things about Ketanji Brown Jackson is that she actually comes from a background of being a public defender. That's the kind of person we needed for years to see much, much, much more of, because it obviously affects the quality of justice that then comes down from the federal bench. And that's been a real priority for Biden. And I think we're going to see, as Ellie said, not just an educational diversity, but a diversity of background and experience in some of the nominees that should make us feel really sanguine about opening up the aperture to who gets to be a judge in America.
And what about the timing of these hearings and President Biden putting the person forward? He could even put the person forward today when he and Breyer will be together at the White House. And also the legacy of Justice Breyer. David Sirota says Breyer has sided with positions taken by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce a majority of times, quote, In practice, that's meant Breyer recently voting to restrict regulators' power to punish Wall Street criminals, to empower fossil fuel companies to brush off environmental concerns and to oppose a state mining ban. It means Breyer voting to shield companies from liability when they face allegations of human rights abuses abroad. It means Breyer voting to limit consumer debt protections, David Sirota wrote. He is also pro-choice, as well as fiercely anti-death penalty. L.A. Mistel.
Breyer has a complicated legacy, as almost all the Supreme Court justices do. He's been a solid liberal, but a moderate version of that. And that moderation, I think that centrist leaning, I think we've seen from him most often in issues of corporate responsibility and general kind of a laissez-faire attitude towards big business, which is problematic in certain ways. But in other ways, he's been the fiercest advocate against the death penalty, I think, on the court that we've had since Marshall, since Thurgood Marshall. I think that's fair. He's been a strong pro-choice advocate. He's been a strong environmental advocate. So, you know, people are complicated. Breyer has a complicated legacy. Look, you would take 9 Stephen Breyers over 1 Neil Gorsuch. Let's not get it twisted. Is he the most fire-breathing lefty that I can think of? No, but quite frankly, I don't think Biden's going to replace him with the most fire-breathing lefty I can think of either. Right? Like that's not the Biden strategy. That wasn't the Obama strategy, quite frankly. So I don't anticipate Biden's nominee being attacked from the left too much, but I don't anticipate Biden's nominee being as left as you could go.
And finally, LA, your headline, Supreme Court versus the Earth.
Yeah, we're in a bad situation right now. So on February 28th, the Supreme Court's going to hear a major case about the Clean Air Act, where it's going to try to limit the EPA's, the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to regulate carbon emissions, greenhouse gases from power plants. That's amazing to me because clean air is like right in the name of the law. But if you understand where conservatives are coming from, they have a generations-long ideological crusade against the administrative state, which includes things like the EPA, which includes, as we saw last month, OSHA. And that's why the conservatives were willing to overturn the OSHA vaccine or test mandate. That's why they will likely stop EPA rulemaking before it's even started, which is another kind of weird thing for them to do, because they're on an ideological crusade. One of the things that people have to understand is that if we let conservatives control the Supreme Court for the next 30 years, that's the next 30 years where we get zero meaningful climate legislation, because the conservative Supreme Court will simply not allow it. So if you care about climate, if you care about the planet, you better start caring about the Supreme Court, because if you don't control the Supreme Court, you will get nothing on climate.
L.A. Mistel, we want to thank you for being with us, Nation's Justice Correspondent. His forthcoming book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, and Dahlia Lithwick, Slate.com Senior Editor and Senior Legal Correspondent. We'll link to your piece as well, The Deep Irony of Stephen Breyer's Bare-Knuckled Exit from the Supreme Court. Next up, we talk to a top Cuban scientist about how Cuba's developed its own COVID vaccines despite the 60-year-old U.S. embargo. Stay with us.
So you're waiting on a coastline, waiting for the right sign, waiting for the opportunity to hit you right. So put me in a line, add another line. Soon you'll have a box and you can put me inside. And put me in a box, boy, put me in a box. Put me in a box and call me anything you want, boy. Put me in a line, put me in a line. Put me in the morning, put my feelings into life. Put me in a box, boy. And call me anything you want, boy. Put me in a line, put me in a line. Put me in the morning, put my feelings into life. And anything goes. Anything you want. And anything goes. Anything you want, you want, you want, you want, you want.
Julie Hendricks. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Cuba has announced plans to deliver as many as 200 million doses of its homegrown COVID vaccines to nations in the global south. Despite the U.S. embargo, Cuba now has one of the highest vaccination rates in the world. Cuba's also announced it'll soon apply for approval by the World Health Organization for one of its vaccines, Abdala, which has been shown to be highly effective. This all comes as Cuba prepares to mark the 60th anniversary of the U.S. embargo, which has severely curtailed Cuba's response to the pandemic, making it harder to import critical medical equipment and supplies. The embargo began on February 7, 1962. By President John F. Kennedy. It's continued under 11 U.S. presidents since then. We're joined now by Dr. Mitchell Valdez-Sosa, the director of the Cuban Center for Neuroscience. He's played a key role in Cuba's response to the pandemic. Welcome to Democracy Now!, doctor. It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about how Cuba has dealt with the pandemic, its plans to give out hundreds of millions of vaccines, and what you're reporting Cuba this month, between seven-day averages of 1 to 4 deaths, daily averages?
Okay. Well, first, thanks for having me on the program. I enjoy your show very much. I watch it frequently in Cuba, so thanks for this invitation. I think Cuba really faced the menace of the pandemic with trepidation. We were really worried because we saw news around the world of people dying, intensive care units being overloaded, and new variants continuously appearing and sweeping around the world. I think the key to the Cuban response is the close coordination and collaboration of all the actors, everyone involved. So one thing that happened is that all the research centers mobilized and started redirecting their work. And then, for example, in the case of my center, which is a center for research on neuroscience, we studied developmental disorders, Alzheimer's disease. We decided to set that aside for a moment and start collaborating in preparing for the response to the pandemic. And one of the things that happened is that several centers got together and we started producing ventilators because there was a shortage of ventilators. One of the effects of the embargo or the blockade, as we call it in Cuba, that the U.S. has imposed on us for so long, it was difficult to get ventilators from the U.S. and even spare parts for ventilators that had been bought before the pandemic. Some of them are from Europe. But what's happening is that if a company supplies something to Cuba and then is bought off by a U.S. company, then they can't sell us the spare parts. And this is a tremendously difficult situation in many areas of medical attention. So and here is something which is interesting because it shows the two sides of the relationships between the U.S. and Cuba. One of the ventilators we started manufacturing is an open source design, which was put on internet by MIT. And this is, I think, very generous. This happened all over the world. People started sharing solutions for the pandemic. I think the pandemic really brought out generosity in people, solidarity. And that's I think, a very interesting aspect. We took the design from MIT, adapted it to Cuban conditions, and we started building the ventilators. That's, let's say, the good side of the coin. But on the other side, we couldn't buy any of the parts in the U.S. And we had to change some of this part of the design, and we had to go to sources far away and sometimes at much higher prices. And this is incredible that in a moment that the whole world was mobilizing to face this tremendous menace that was killing people around the world, the U.S. administration did not lift any of the more than 400 sanctions that were slapped on Cuba during the Trump administration, plus this decades-long embargo. It didn't budge an inch. So all that Cuba did, and I think we were very successful. If you look at the rates of death in of people that died in Cuba, of people that were infected at different moments, Cuba has been very successful compared to every country in this continent. And I think we achieved this because there was a massive response of all the population supporting all the measures that the public health system started orienting, and every resource in the country was mobilized. To finish the story about our ventilators, we managed to manufacture 250 ventilators that were delivered to hospitals all over Cuba. And immediately after this, we started working on a second ventilator. I mean, the second design was also open source from the UCL in the UK. They were very helpful, managed to collaborate. Cubans there that live in the UK, they did crowdfunding. They got the funds. They bought the parts, the components, sent it to Cuba. We got help from the European Union, from the World Health Organization, and we managed to start manufacturing another 250 ventilators. And this it was something that was done with collaboration from many research centers, people working very hard, working nights, working weekends, and I think we managed to help the health system manage this very difficult situation, which became much tougher after the new variants came up, first Delta and then Omicron. But I think that the really interesting aspect of this work is how Cuba, in less than a year, managed to develop three vaccines. And the embargo is really crippling, because you need to manufacture vaccines, production facilities, you need different fermenters. If you're going to make it through genetic engineering, you need chemicals, you need all kinds of supplies. And it was very trying to get this, because the impact of the embargo is not only that we cannot buy in the U.S., there are two additional add-on effects which make things difficult. One is that European or Japanese suppliers get scared off. We have negotiated, we've tried to buy materials from people in Europe, and they say, well, we could sell, but we would get into trouble with the U.S. We have big contracts in the U.S. So that's one of the additional knock-on effects of the U.S. embargo. And the second is that even though we sell products, Cuban products abroad, and that's what the Cuban pharmaceutical and biotechnological industry does. It sells products abroad, but to buy raw materials to be able to manufacture the subsidized and very low-cost medicines and products that are sold to the Cuban population. And when we try to bring the funds to Cuba, we try to use them, then all the bank operations are hampered by U.S. regulations. So the embargo has a very strong effect, a very noxious effect on the development of anything. But despite this, in 1 year, Cuba managed to develop its three vaccines, and now there's a fourth vaccine on the way. The interesting thing is that the rollout of the vaccines was very, very effective and very easy. There's I'd say the Cuban population, the Cuban people, have great trust in their health system. They don't see it as something that's separate from them. They collaborate with it. It's not a money-making machine. The public health in Cuba is free for everyone. We have family doctors in every neighborhood. People trust their doctors. So we're very puzzled when we see the news abroad that there are people that distrust the vaccines, that there are people that don't want to get vaccinated. In Cuba, there's no vaccine mandate, but people just line up and are really anxious and enthusiastic to get vaccines. And we have over 80% of all the population with the full vaccination program. Everybody's been vaccinated, and now we're rolling out a booster, an additional booster vaccine. Over 50% of the population has received the booster. At our center, in addition to redirecting our work to manufacture ventilators. We also set up a vaccination center. We gave over 6,000 shots. The doctors and nurses that work at our center volunteered, and they were working very hard. And just people would call and come with enthusiasm. And I think the important thing is that there's been years of working up trust in science. People feel that the future of the country is really connected to science. And they see the scientists that develop the vaccines as heroes. Even some of the most popular songwriters and musicians have written songs about the vaccines and about the doctors. And I think this is part of a really consistent message of all society. When you see on Cuban TV anyone talking, it could be the president, it could be a minister, it could be a teacher, a sportsman, everybody's masked up. This has been a consistent message to all the population. And every day, the Ministry of Public Health on television reports how many cases they are, if there's any deaths. And this problem of keeping the public informed and of being talking straight to them and really giving them information has been very useful. And while I think we've been very successful in controlling this pandemic, although it's been incredibly difficult, and we've had to manage and invent many, many ways to work around all the negative effects of the embargo.
And, Doctor, despite the effectiveness of the vaccines that Cuba has developed, they've not yet received approval from the World Health Organization. Could you explain why you think that is and what steps Cuba is taking to ensure that that approval comes? Because Cuba has also made commitments to donate vaccines or to give vaccines to low-income countries, and WHO approval is important for that.
Yeah. WHO approval is very important, and Cuba is in conversations with the WHO to obtain this approval. But it's not a barrier, because the regulatory body of every country has the right to decide which vaccines it uses. So the equivalent of the FDA in different parts of the world are examining the Cuban vaccines. And for example, in Vietnam and Venezuela and recently in Mexico, they have approved using the Cuban vaccines. Cuba is working with the World Health Organization and it's finishing a new production plant in Mariel, the latest technology. And the idea is transferring production of vaccines to this new facility, so it will have all the possibility of receiving an inspection by the World Health Organization and being finally approved. But this does not impede, it's not an absolute barrier, because other countries can use their regulatory bodies, and they're doing so. And so countries are now receiving Cuban vaccines. We think at the beginning of this year, we will have this approval, and this process will be finished. This new production facility, it's called Mariel CIGB, it was just finished, and it's really top-notch. It has the most advanced technologies for production of biotech products, and we're sure it will come out very successful in the inspections that are needed for approval by the World Health Organization. But that does not limit the possibility of helping other countries, and that's going on now at this moment.
Dr. Valdez-Sosa, we only have a minute, but could you explain what plans Cuba has for technology transfer to allow other countries to manufacture Cuban vaccines?
Okay. This is already going on. Cuba has now reached an agreement with the Pasteur Institute in Iran, and they are now producing the Cuban Soberana vaccine. And Cuba is negotiating with other countries and is open to share its technology so it can be used worldwide. One of the concerns we had when the epidemic began is that we knew that there would be a shortage of vaccines to reach everyone. And it's absolutely clear if we don't vaccinate the whole world population, there's going to be the risk, and it's almost certain that new variants will arise, and some of them will be able to circumvent and to get around the defenses that previous vaccines have achieved. Cuba's very open to this. We're part of the global south, and we understand that medicines and vaccines are not a commodity. It's not something to get rich with. It's something to save people's lives. And we're really in favor of sharing technology and of working with people around the world.
Dr. Mitchell Valdez-Soso, we want to thank you for being with us, director of the Cuban Center for Neuroscience. Next up is the Federal Reserve signals it's going to raise interest rates. We'll talk to business reporter Christopher Leonard, author of The Lords of Easy Money. He says the Fed's broken the U.S. economy. Back in 30 seconds. This Note's for You by Neil Young, who demanded Spotify this week remove his music from its streaming service if it wouldn't drop the podcast of Joe Rogan, who's repeatedly spread misinformation about COVID-19 and vaccines. Neil Young said they can have Rogan or Young, not both. Spotify is removing Neil Young's music. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Amidst growing concerns about inflation in the U.S., the Federal Reserve announced Tuesday it'll start hiking interest rates in March. To look at what this will mean for working people and everyone beyond the 1%, we're joined by Christopher Leonard, longtime business reporter. His new book is out this week, The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Christopher. If you can start off with a Federal Reserve 101, what does it mean to lift interest rates, and why do you say it's broken the American economy?
Yes, thank you. Great question. And, you know, the Federal Reserve can seem like this very kind of obscure and highly technical institution that only matters to Wall Street. But I really think that's not the case. It is critical to understand what this central bank does and how it has affected our economy. You know, one of my central preoccupations as a business reporter is trying to understand growing income inequality in the United States and why we live in this sort of funhouse type economy where we can see stock markets breaking records, corporate debt markets breaking records, while the middle class is really treading water with stagnant wages and falling further behind. What the Federal Reserve has done over the last decade helps explain why this is happening. So, you know, at the root level, we created the Federal Reserve as the central bank to do one key thing. It creates our currency. The Federal Reserve literally creates and manages our currency. That thing we call a U.S. dollar is in reality a Federal Reserve note. So the central bank's job is to make sure that the dollar retains its value. So that's why you always hear this talk about this, you know, the Federal Reserve hiked interest rates today or cut interest rates today. What they're doing is expanding or contracting the supply of money. So why does that matter? Well, here's why. Over the last decade, the Fed has really moved itself to the center of American economic life. The Fed has engaged in an unprecedented series of experiments in printing new money. Let me put it this way. In the first century of its existence, the Fed expanded the pool of base money, you know, what the economists call the monetary base. The Fed expanded that pool of money to about $900 billion. So that's $1 trillion in printing money over a century. But then after the crash of 2008, between 2008 and 2014, the Fed prints $3.5 trillion. So that's 3.5 centuries worth of money printing in a few short years. Now, that money is not a neutral force. When the Fed creates new dollars, it doesn't create them in the checking account of normal people, right? It creates new dollars specifically, and by design, it creates new dollars on Wall Street in the bank accounts of 24 select institutions. And they're the folks you'd suspect, you know, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo. That's where the Fed is creating these new dollars. So the Fed's policies over the last decades have stoked the world of Wall Street. It has pumped trillions of dollars into the banking system, and thereby it's inflated these markets for stocks, for bonds. And that drives income inequality because, you know, just the tiny 1% at the top of our wealth ladder controls 40% of all the assets. Whereas the bottom half of Americans, you know, those of us who earn a living by getting a paycheck rather than by owning assets, the bottom half of Americans only own about 5% of all the assets. So the Fed's policies have enriched the very rich, the biggest of the big banks, while leaving the middle class behind. And now we find ourselves in this position that's really actually quite a dangerous moment in 2022, where we're seeing price inflation start to increase dramatically. So the Fed is being forced to tighten the money supply and to try to back off these stimulus programs it's created. The real risk here, I think, for everybody in America is that as the Fed does this, as it hikes rates and pulls back on the stimulus, it's going to cause those asset markets to fall. And you know, to put that in common parlance, it's risking creating a financial market crash as the Fed is forced to hike interest rates. And again, to me, one of the key problems with this is that over the decade of these easy money policies, the middle class has really been left out. And once again, it'll be the middle class that's going to have to pay the bill if we see another financial market crash.
Well, Chris, could you respond to what we see everywhere in the media, namely that inflation rates now are almost at 7%, higher than they've been since the 1980s? I mean, that level of inflation also impacts the vast majority of Americans adversely. What other steps could be taken to reduce inflation?
So it's just fascinating. And one key thing I would really like to point out that I learned while reporting this book is that we should, I think about two kinds of inflation. There's inflation of prices, which is what we're talking about right now, that really sharp increase in the price of food, fuel, television sets, cars. That's price inflation. But then you've got inflation of assets, which is what the Fed has been pushing so hard for decades. So that's, you know, a rise in the value of homes and stocks and corporate bonds. So we've actually had runaway asset inflation for a decade, but we haven't seen price inflation, and we're starting to see it now. And as you point out, price inflation can just frankly be devastating for the middle class if wages don't keep up with the increase in prices, which unfortunately is exactly what we're seeing now. So wages are kind of creeping up a little bit, but we're seeing this runaway increase in prices, which presents us with a terrible dilemma. And to be blunt, the Federal Reserve is responsible for the price inflation, at least to a certain degree, by pumping all of this money into the economy. So, you know, your question is, how can you fight it and what can you do?
We have 30 seconds.
Quite unfortunately, one of the few ways to do this is to hike interest rates, which is going to create damage to our economy. Many other important measures will take a lot of time, you know, such as, improving the supply chain or cracking down on monopolies. So we're going to see interest rates hiked, and it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Well, we clearly have to come back to this conversation. Christopher Leonard, business reporter and author, new book out this week. It's called The Lords of Easy Money, How the Federal Reserve Broke the American Economy. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.